With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
And welcome to Superfan Chats, the show where we get to nerd out about our favorite podcast, No Small Roles. Yay!
Yay!
I'm Superfan Han, one of the Superfan Hans, and today I am joined by
Superfan Pip
and Superfan Jeremy.
Yeah. I love that.
I almost wanted to say Jay, because you said Pip instead of Pippa, and I wanted to be like, Jay?
Well, we don't have Sam with us today, and usually Sam, Han, no. And Pip, we've got one-syllable things going on. We need to get a one-syllable name for you.
Okay, so it's, should it be Jay? Should it be Jay?
It could be Jay.
Okay, super fan Ham, I'm about to say Ham. Han, Han, Pip, and Jay?
That works.
Sounds like PB and J almost.
Oh my God, I love it. It's like our super fan alter egos, like we're kind of superheroes.
Exactly.
And our superpower is being really obsessed with No Small Roles.
Done. Love it.
So we're doing, as you said, we're missing Sam today. Boo. Sorry, Sam. And the other super fan Han. But I think we've established that if we get into a room together, it's going to be the apocalypse.
You'll both spontaneously combust.
Yeah, and we're already close enough to do an apocalypse, I think, in general.
Yes.
So maybe let's not tempt fate.
Let us save us all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to do a slightly shorter one today as well. We're going to do episodes 58, 59, and 60,
mm-hmm.
not our usual four.
Yeah.
And then I think there's going to be another one with another three coming out pretty soon.
Yes.
So
what a time to be alive.
Almost like a six pack of super fan episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I'll jump right in with episode 58.
Yeah,
unless
please do.
Got some hot goss to share.
I was going to say, when you were talking about alter egos, it reminded me of a thing that I did in a game where there was this society that was like obsessed with like fae stuff. And they all had ridiculous alter egos that they used specific. There was like a bunch of rich people in this club, and they all gave themselves like weird fae alter egos. And when the players showed up, they had to be given alter egos as well that they only used in the Grisante Fellowship is the name of it. And it was,
oh my God,
that's what it reminds me of.
That sounds so fun.
I struggle with names at the best of times, so I find that epically confusing, but I love it.
Yeah.
I'm about to start DMing for fun the Wild Beyond the Witchlight, and
ooh.
I'm excited for all the fae trickery. It's going to be good. But every character has like five names, and I'm like,
oh, no.
I'm going to need a really good tracker in front of me, like all the post-it notes being like, this character is also called these other things. Do not forget.
I mean, some of the No Small Roles characters have got quite a few names as well, to be fair.
Oh my God, they
do. How many does Gwen have? Is it only two at this point or more?
I think we suspect two, but there could be more lurking in there.
Yeah. I found the list of some of these names. We never got their actual names for most of them.
Yeah.
So that we got Charlotte Frosty Gem, Bane Moonfig, Zephyr Bumbleshadow, Nyx Greybloom.
I love it.
Bramble Bubble Leaf, Ginkgo Carrot Bay, oh, and Dew Turtle Frost.
I love the fae stuff because it's just an excuse to be so whimsical and so silly. It's great.
Yeah, it's good times.
Although what's not whimsical and silly was episode 58.
No, it was
Silent Spectre. So this episode picked up right after the attack on Taimon Prevost. Mm-hmm. And Enkidu had just like punched the soul out of a dude, which was a thing that Enkidu decided to do.
Yeah.
One of Enkidu's impulsive decisions, sort of trademark.
Sometimes you gotta punch the soul out of a guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you just like, I gotta do it.
Yeah. Dark, but necessary.
So I think last time in Superfan Chats, we were talking about, is it Spirit Jar or what was the...
Magic Jar.
No, it's a different one.
Oh, Magic Jar. Magic Jar is where your soul gets stored in an item. I think, I forget what his ability was. It's like, it's a Cursed Specter, I think.
That's the one.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he put his Hexblade's curse on somebody. When they die, he gets to keep their
to keep their soul. And we were talking about how you get the soul, but it doesn't have any useful information. Or when you're sort of following rules as written, it doesn't have any like useful information. But David being a fun homebrewy type DM and the cast being super creative means that sometimes these things go in directions we don't expect for our delight. And Enkidu managed to circumvent the fact that this specter can't talk by remembering that he picked up some parchment and a pencil literally earlier that day in the pub and got it to write down a whole bunch of really important information. So we find out about Havoc, this other force or faction that is sometimes working with the Hex, sometimes not, who are the ones who caused the attack. We learn that they're not really up for having any kind of person on the throne. Their sole mission seems to be to just sow chaos, which I can get behind. As we've established, we love chaos. And we also find out who Rings is, the guy taking the shipment. So someone called Pellegrie, and where they are and what they're doing. And they're based, the people who did the attack and are based in a house on Sallow Street, number 16. And honestly, the whole cast worked really, really hard to get this information out of the Spectre. Like, David does a really amazing job of being extremely evasive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then something that Gwen points out, which then happens, is she's like, oh, when you release it, what if it just goes back into its body and gets resurrected? And then they know that they're after us. And that's literally what happens as soon as Enkidu releases it. So now they have a member of Havoc who has a lot of information about them and knows they've given them a lot of information kind of out there, which is a bit unnerving.
Knows most of their names, knows exactly what they look like.
Yep. Knows they can punch a soul out of a dude.
Yep.
Yeah, like knows a lot of it. Like, yeah, knows what kind of what their powers are.
Yeah. Knows they're really interested in the fight for the monarchy, knows that they're probably on Taimon Prevost's side. Like, for an enemy, they have a very large amount of information about them, which I think is probably not going to turn out great.
No.
It's definitely adding like another layer of unease to this multi-layered campaign that David is building. Like, this string is now connected over here on the murder wall. It's like turning into a big web. So then after that, they decide they're going to go talk to Taimon Prevost. So Juna uses her sending to get in touch, and they go to a house in Plumbridge.
Yes.
And I've forgotten, Deromanet House.
Deromanet, that's it.
Yes, that's it. Deromanet House in Plumbridge to go talk to Taimon Prevost. And Gwen basically just rows them there down the river, the River Plume, to the bridge, hence Plumbridge, which I thought was a lovely, again, the world building in this campaign is just amazing.
Yeah.
And if you're on Patreon and get to see some of the maps, what a treat. I mean, David's world building skills, I'm in awe, to be honest. Like, I don't think I have the patience to build cities like that.
Yeah. Did he say whether he uses a generator or did he just draw it all by hand?
I have a feeling that he creates it all.
I think the majority of it comes from him. Yeah.
From his own brain.
Word etymologies and sort of.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. I really feel like whenever I see his work, I'm always like, oh, I just Google city generator and just plug in some stuff. Oh, I feel lazy.
This man's got a wife and a child. How does he have time?
And a full-time job.
Yes.
That isn't D&D. How does he do that? So they get there, and Kasula's there, Timon Prevost is there, and a guy called Quince is there, who they find out is the new Lord of Tillisham.
Yes.
And again, kind of upending what we sort of thought about this guy, he's like, oh, I'm the new Lord of Tillisham, but actually I don't really care about Tillisham. I've installed a council of people, and Jenny is on the council.
Yes.
So they have a chat about Jenny being on the council, which is great.
I don't think they'd have had any choice.
So yeah, I've installed a council. They can do what they want. You know, the locals should run their local area because I don't know anything about it. And I was like, ah, I like this. This is weird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like this guy. He sounds reasonable. Prevost is very adamant that he's going to keep going out and showing his face despite the attacks, and is very much like trying to get the people on his side. Mm-hmm. And we also find out a lot more about the sort of fight for the claim to the throne, and that it's kind of weirdly complicated. So there's this whole situation where Timon Prevost has a really good claim, but the steward is refusing to test his blood to prove that he is a descendant of the previous king. Mm-hmm. Whereas Beryon doesn't have such a strong claim, but because of the refusal to test, it's more of a fight than it feels like it should be. So there's something weird going on there with the steward. We also learn that the steward doesn't like Beryon. So it kind of is like a big question as to like, why is this happening in the first place?
Yeah.
Mm.
Unclear. So I guess I kind of feel like this episode was really split into two parts. The first part where they're sort of gathering this information about Havok and Sallow 16 and all that. And then the second part where they're sort of delivering all this information to Timon Prevost and kind of forging alliances and trying to figure out what to do. And Kidu also lets slip that Erida told him he's got royal blood, which is like, wait, what? Maybe I wasn't paying attention in earlier episodes and that's come out before, but I was like, hang on a second, what? he's got royal, what? I just thought he had a royal person in his brain.
Well, yeah,
was a ghost, like one of the ghosts in his brain. Apparently not. Apparently there's something else going on there. And we also had a little bit more interaction between Gwen and Kasula, which was really interesting.
Yes.
And start setting up some really lovely stuff for the coming episodes. And I feel like all the characters really had like really great moments in this episode. Like everybody had something they kind of helped out with or kind of, oh, Gaius asked the Spectre about the Hex and whether he knew
and about his siblings.
His siblings and whether his siblings were around, and it was confirmed that his siblings are a part of the Hex, and Gaius is like freaking out. And then there was some like lovely Gaius and Juna bonding, which was super cute.
Mm.
And yeah, I think Oren stayed pretty quiet, but I get the sense that there's a lot going on sort of in terms of connecting the dots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a really interesting episode. I think as a companion to the previous episode, which was like really fast paced and like action packed, it was really nice to then get all this like super information download.
Yes.
And really get to start connecting some bits and pieces about like the wider political landscape, and also like hearing about, I feel like there's this new faction in a way that has now appeared.
So well, the children
we knew
of
about
Havok.
The Hex. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We knew about the Hex before, and now there's the Children of Havok, and it's like, ooh, there's not just one sort of criminal element. There are maybe competing ones, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that, you know, you would expect maybe with kind of gang warfare and things that they would maybe almost, the expectation would be that they would be rival factions, but that doesn't really seem to be the case. They seem to have different aims and different goals. They seem to be like operating out of the same sort of city, but they don't seem to be at war with each other.
Yeah.
Which I find quite interesting.
And they asked the Spectre like, oh, do you work with the Hex? And the Spectre kind of wrote down sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah.
It makes me think that there is some connection maybe in the leadership of the two groups.
Yes.
Either that they are currently connected or that they used to be connected. Because I'm just imagining like, surely if you are two factions who are both operating independently in the same space, if you run into each other, but both of you are like straight up anarchic. Well, I don't know if I would call the Hex anarchists necessarily, but the Children of Havoc are certainly.
Yeah, definitely
an anarchist organization. I would imagine that coming into contact with another organization would typically result in conflict rather than cooperation.
Yeah.
So that makes me think that either the leadership decided to work together or they already knew each other. I really like the idea that there are multiple factions. I think in a real world scenario, you would have a bunch of different groups who would be vying for power in a situation like this.
Yes.
So I think having it here makes it feel more lived in and real. And my big thing about this episode, as well as whenever we get into these kinds of topics, is like, dang, should we just give up the whole spoons thing and go deal with this Game of Thrones drama happening like for the succession? I feel like the prize ain't worth it. Let's go figure it out.
It's probably been won by now. Let's be honest, you know.
Come on. Yeah. They've been doing this for how long?
I completely forgot about the spoons.
Yeah, I know. There must be some team who's got a way of getting from, you know, town to town really quickly. Four spoons in this one, two in this one, two in this one, two in this one. Done. Oh, I've done it in 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, especially if you have polymorph or any spells like that, which our group is, they're high enough level to have polymorph.
Juna has polymorph.
Yeah.
She was a walrus.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've lost. I feel like we've already lost the spoons. Let's just go figure out the whole thing with the king or maybe find like a therapist to work with Enkidu.
Yeah, the demonologist.
And figure out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That was another cool thing is we got a bit more about like his actual goals are pulling him towards the hills.
Mm-hmm.
The Phalosian hills.
I wanted to both say Fomorian, which is not that. No, that is Feywild Underdark Fomorians. Or I wanted to say Fallopian, which is also what the cast want to call them.
Yep.
No, the Phalosian hills. And then, but it says Erida's prime directive is pulling him south, which is kind of weird. So there's a conflict, like literally within, I mean, there's multiple conflicts inside Enkidu. Like you say, he definitely needs a therapist.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, part of me is like, guys, let's pause what we're doing with all this stuff. And we are going to track down the most brilliant arcanist or artificer, somebody who can take up Enkidu apart, look at him and figure out what's going on. And like
what has happened?
Yes. And don't tell Enkidu. Not that we don't like Enkidu, but I don't think he has any choice but to have Erida potentially go through his memory. So just don't tell him what you're doing. Put him in a bag of holding. He'll live.
Yeah, he will.
He would God.
Yeah, just they really should be taking advantage of the fact that he can't breathe more often. Just to, if they need to sneak in anywhere, he climbs into the bag of holding. They just take him in, and then like he just pops out.
Just chuck him in a hole. It's fine. Yeah, this was a really good episode for all the lore drops, but also the personal lore, like all the stuff with Gwen. And I know we've had a lot of Juna backstory as well, and I'm really curious to see how this ties in with the petals and the strings and then obviously I also wanted I really wanted that sense of like, okay, fuck the spoons. Like, there's also Gaius's family around.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, can we figure this out? Because I'm still convinced there's a bunch of stuff Gaius isn't telling them, because no way he's that on it. I still feel like there's something going on in there.
Juna does some like detect thoughts on him while he's asleep, something like that. Hold him down.
Detect dreams.
Whilst inside the zone of truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also all that Oren's keeping his cards close to the chest as well. You know, there's all kinds of stuff about, you know, him and the Wingthrups and the Woden Isles and the people he knows and
how old he is. Do we still not know how old he is? And who that captain was?
Yes.
He's so mysterious.
There's
so many threads that are just like kind of running at the same time. And the whole group is like, but what about the spoons?
Yeah. Priorities, guys.
Yes. At the time of recording this, we're on episode 63, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I... They are playing the longest of long games right now because there are yeah. so many plot lines. I don't know if you can wrap this up before episode 100.
Yeah.
Realistically, like, because each of these could theoretically have another 4 to 5 episodes, yeah. like each of these mysteries, yeah. 4 to 5 episodes plus mm-hmm. just dealing with this and all the other stuff are like, whew, yeah. we're into this for the long haul.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. And I really thought in this episode they were going to at least like wrap up some of the Beryon stuff because they were like, oh, we have proof he's drugging people. And then they looked at their proof and it was bad.
Yeah. Inconclusive.
Brevos was like, this proves
nothing.
Nope. I believe you that he's doing it, but we can't use this random note that says something about Alec Ludder. Mm-hmm. Like that doesn't give me anything. It doesn't say like, yes, I agree to have the shipment of frosting put into the cupcakes for all my followers. Like it's not a smoking crossbow.
Yeah, smoking crossbow.
Love it.
It's amazing.
So yeah, I really thought that was gonna come to something, but it also didn't. So then another thread that's just, like you say, the longest of long games. Mm.
So I got a full, if I was wearing a hat, I would tip it to Baby David and the cast. Baby David, obviously, because he's the ringmaster who has to keep all of these things going and be like, it's been enough time since we touched on that. Let's go back and touch, you know, advance this storyline a bit longer. And then also the cast who has to keep track as well of like when we've gone back to this, it's like, oh, yes. And now I have to be invested in this storyline that the last time we recorded an episode for this was last year.
Yeah. And it's all right for us, we can go back and listen to them as many times as we want, but they have to do it in real time.
Yeah.
I wonder how many of them re-listen to the episodes that have come out or that they have recordings of before they play again, just to like try and remember some stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I would like to offer a big keg of Twain Tide tea to Baby David and the whole cast for their efforts.
Yeah, for sure.
It's great.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's good stuff. Well, do you want to talk about episode 59?
Yeah, let's move on to Sallow 16.
Yes. So this episode was packed with a lot of emotion and events, but in terms of actual specific things that happened, not that many things actually happened. So they've agreed that they're going to go try and find the Children of Havoc. They have Quince go out and try and find Arcanist Zarevir Taric to try and get her help, which, by the way, this was the point at which it started to hit me, not having spellings for some of these names.
Yeah, I
am
I know.
Absolutely taking swings at some of the... Zarevir Taric could be spelled so many ways.
Oh, I know.
It also speaks to the phonetic inconsistency of English. But anyway, they plan to rendezvous closer to the hideout, which is, of course, Sallow 16. Kasula had pointed out Sallow 16 for them on a map. They scouted the whole area out with Ruana. Okay, this is a full-on courtyard of apartment buildings. Great. Innocent bystanders. That's what we love to see. The children were either in the top floor or the basement. So we got to pick one option. Gwen, as they were about to go in, I believe, got a message from Zarevir saying that the Arcanists had been removed from the job mysteriously and abruptly, and that other Arcanists were on their way. So you guys got to get this thing done ASAP. Now things are starting to look real suspicious. The party's like, cool, let's do it. They go for the basement. They get stuck with a locked door. Of course, the bane of every D&D group.
Doors.
Yes. They finally make their way through the door, and then they find Pellegrin, a name that reminds me of both Pedigree and Pelennor.
And Pelican,
yes. and they find Pellegrin packing up his storeroom, getting ready to be teleported away. But they're like, we gotta, and they realize there's all these arcane defenses. There's all these wards placed that they can't get any closer. So they literally just talk to the guy and they're trying to find information. Of course, he's just like, I have no reason to give you any information beyond what and finally Gwen and Guy are like, okay, we've had enough of this. We are going to try and pincer move this guy.
Yeah.
Let's try and sneak around to a different location. And this is where I got, things get a little bit hazy for me. So Enkidu reaches out to Erida And I'm not sure if he reaches out to her, which triggers her sending who we eventually find out is the Arcanist Exissa Wingthrup, mm-hmm. or if Exissa was already on the way and Enkidu just happened to connect to Erida in time for like right before Exissa showed up.
Yeah. Mm.
But regardless, the Arcanist Exissa Wingthrup appears with some this crack team of like the SEAL Team 6 of elite mages, yeah. like the most powerful characters we've seen in this series, short of maybe Crawl, show up. They immediately incapacitate Pellegree. They get rid of all of the wards in an instant, just jump in, take the guy down, and then they just tell the party to leave. Congratulations, we've done this. We're the Special Forces. You guys, the regular old like transportation crew can leave.
Oh my God. It's like the local cops being upstaged by a SWAT team. Yes. Yeah. The yep. FBI.
Yeah. Or like the SAS coming in and sending out like the normal, yeah, yeah, yeah. Military forces. Or if you're American, the Green Berets or Army Rangers showing up and just sending everybody home. But they of course, no one likes this. Number one thing for any D&D party is people hate to lose. If your plan depends on the team losing, it is not a good plan because players hate to lose and will do anything to try and stop from losing, which is what happens here. Guy attempts to use his ring of suggestion to force Exissa Wingthrup to give him answers. She does indeed fail the save, but unfortunately, they realize what he was doing and just stab through his hand, pin it to a wall, take the ring. Possibly, is that the most directly like gruesome injury that has taken place at least to one of the cast members?
I guess so, apart from losing Enkidu, but
yeah, it seems like it in terms of like quite graphically described,
yeah,
like outside of like a regular old fight where stuff happens and fireballs,
yeah,
are thrown.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that feels much more like a direct torture kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's because it's so specific. Like, usually it's like, oh, you get slashed.
Yeah.
It's not like they slash you in this specific part of the body and this, you know, that it's like, ooh, yeah, stabbed through the hand. That's one of those.
I know. And there's something about it being pinned to the wall as well. Like,
yeah, like it went all the way through.
And he's a bard.
I was going to say, yeah, he's a musician.
His hands. Yes.
No good. No good. They took his ring.
Yeah, that's gone.
Yeah, there was basically a standoff where the party was just like, and the Arcanists were like, you ought to leave, is what you ought to do.
Yeah. And they got two questions out of it.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yes. So at least we got a little bit, but... But we still
hadn't really thought the questions through.
No, it did not. They did not get anything really that they wanted. The episode ended, I feel, with no one happy but the Arcanists. Specifically, Exissa Wingthrup seemed to be the only person who was even mildly pleased.
Yeah.
And the party left full Charlie Brown mode, head hanging, the sad Christmas time is here playing on the piano.
Oh.
And that's how the episode ended.
Oh, bless them. It was one of those situations where they were like, haha, a really important NPC that we definitely have questions for. What are the questions?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
What do we do? Oh, yep. It's too late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in that situation, that would totally happen, wouldn't it? Your brain, yeah, would just go absolutely dead and you'd be like, well, I know, I would be just not be able to think of anything that I would have wanted to have thought of until the moment I left. Mm. But it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the level of like violence and power that was displayed was so abrupt and shocking that like most people would just be like, because they're still a dude with his hand pinned to a wall.
Yeah.
And you're just, can he have his hand back?
Yeah. Are you going to, let him go? Personally, I think I, as a listener, had really underestimated the Arcanists. Like, I knew they were a powerful group of people.
Yeah.
But I really hadn't considered the level of power that they were wielding and just how dangerous they could be.
Sure.
Because, I don't know, I was like, oh, they're these, like, important wizardy people. Like, how strong can they be? You know, it's an adventuring party. Like, oh, they're not going to be that dangerous. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, no. These are people you do not want to mess with, at least until level 15.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, these, our characters are not low level. What are they, level 9 now?
Yeah, they're getting pretty tough.
They leveled up at the start of this episode, I think, didn't they?
Yeah. They're level 8 or 9, I think. Yeah. Which is like, that's pretty strong. You got up to 5th level spells. And they just got washed.
Yeah.
I never got the impression that, like, granted, this is not the most high damage party, but still, I did not get the impression that they would even be able to take down a single Arcanist before things immediately turned against them.
Yeah. And that also bodes in a very scary way, really badly in terms of the Wingthrups, because Excessive Wingthrup is an Arcanist. And then we also know about, like, the Golem army that is still being built.
Yeah.
That didn't stop. Yep. There's a whole, you know, and Erid is super powerful. The supercomputer, you know, that is also there. Like, there's a lot of really scary high level stuff that is going on that they have been clearly shown that the party is just not equipped to tackle yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is just not possible.
Which is a great way of making the world feel larger as well. Like, it's one thing to be like, oh, there's a bunch of stuff happening over there that is still going. But it's also another thing to be like, hey, as strong as you guys are, you're really pitiful compared to these people.
Yeah. And it's really interesting seeing that in comparison to, like, the Hex and the Children of Havoc, where that kind of feels more on their level, where they can kind of compete with these guys, where it's like, okay, it's a tough fight, but they can, like, blow up their hideout or, you know, kind of take them down in a fight as long as they're not behind magical wards.
Yeah.
Whereas suddenly, like you say, you come up against this other force and it's like, oh, there is a real hierarchy and there are people in this world who are more powerful. And it suddenly, yeah, like you say, it really widens the scope in a really instantaneous and quite dramatic way. It was really intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also gives you an idea of what the Children and the Hex are up against.
Yeah.
It's a real Rebels Empire feel. Like, we just saw like a Grand Moff appear and just show just how much stronger the Empire is compared to the Rebel forces. And it's like, oh, dang. Oh, no. Okay. It's rough out here for everybody. It explains why these groups X-wing. Are so hardcore.
Because
that's what you're up against. These people showed up. They incapacitated this man in a single round.
Yeah.
It's like, oh. Yeah, I get all the secrecy now as well.
Yeah,
you have to be really careful.
Yeah.
I think what I found surprising as well was that when they first got through the arcane door and then Pellegrini said, oh, don't come any closer, and they were having a chat, he seemed so secure behind that arcane, like the pillars with the runes on them. And it's almost like he didn't expect the Arcanist to come busting in and just take it down in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder how much of a dealing the Children of Havoc have even had with the Arcanist up to that point. Or is it all just a play? Although, no, he lost an arm, didn't he, to be fair?
Didn't they also take his ring, like his resurrection?
Yeah, he had one single ring left on his finger.
Yeah.
And they just took his whole arm off, or took his whole hand off.
Oh my God.
Because Enkidu was trying to get the hand.
Yes. But it had fallen near the Arcanist, so he wasn't able to get over
there.
It feels like this man didn't think, as many wards as he put in place, seems like he truly did not count on this as a possibility.
Yeah.
And the last ward should have been something that would blow him up if they got, if somebody got too close. And then the ring would just bring him back, rather than have him get captured and, I guess, tortured. We'll see what happens to him in the end. I don't know. But
well, because we know from the last episode that they can teleport bodies away and resurrect them as well. So that, like you say, that should have been the thing that happened, is if he went down, he would have just been immediately teleported somewhere else to either be resurrected or, like, be at very low health and kind of, you know, just not there. But yeah, that seemed, like you say, it seems like a real surprise to everyone that he got captured.
Yeah. It, well, I guess with the idea of, I mean, it makes sense that he wasn't expecting the Arcanists then, because no one expected these Arcanists. The other Arcanists didn't expect these Arcanists. So who is it? Who's the one pulling the strings?
And it makes me wonder as well, like, within the Arcanists, you know, there's that whole sense that, like, well, we know from ages ago that there's something weird going on with the Arcanists. There's some kind of corruption or double crossing happening. And I was wondering, like, are some of the Arcanists actually hiring the Children of Havoc to cause disruption? And I know there was extreme violence happening here, but was that all an illusion?
Oh.
Was it like a fake, like double cross kind of situation? Like, they, who knows?
Yeah.
I feel like it could be anything with David's brain.
Yeah.
They could have cast regeneration on him immediately after they left. Maybe that was why they kept wanting them to leave, is so this man doesn't bleed out on the ground behind them, and they can just stick the arm back on.
You know, we're not going to be able to bring him back. Get out of here, guys.
I didn't bring the diamonds.
I wouldn't put it past a Winthrop, to be honest. You know, they could do anything. I don't trust anyone.
maybe Pellegrin is a Winthrop.
Oh, my God. Maybe he's one of the Winthrop soldiers like Enkidu.
Oh, how deep does the Winthrop wabbit hole go?
It feels like with David, anything could be possible. There could be any kind of twist or connection. Mm-hmm. I feel like he's just got so many ideas.
We've spent so much time just talking about, just asking questions. Like every episode is like, what's going on?
What if?
which I guess brings us to episode 60.
Episode 60. So this is very aptly titled Reflection. And again, it feels like an episode of two halves again, where you've got the party just feeling absolutely dejected at the beginning of it, where this episode before it, just everything has not gone the way they wanted it to. And the first thing that happens is Enkidu just flies off. He just disappears. He needs some time to himself. Doesn't want to be around the party. And he's just off. He just goes. So they quickly realize that maybe they need somebody to try and follow him. Juno casts fly on Guy. And they try and follow him, but they lose him in the clouds. Meanwhile, Orin and Gwen decide they're going to head back to Plumbridge. They go via the Arcanist Consortium just to have a little sneaky look around, a little sneaky peek. Enkidu lands in the Vale and has a little look around the Lord's Assembly. He has a little short rest and he also does an inside check and rolls an 8 and then has a conversation with, this is Hina, isn't it? The tiefling. Mm-hmm. And I really love every time he does an inside check because we get just a word or two that makes us go, ooh, let's hear more about that. And the thing he mentions, which I don't know how much we've heard about, I'm going to throw it over to you guys because maybe I'm just misremembering things. But he mentions the words, the Fields of Valor. Now, is that where maybe he had the fight with Alcibiades? That's what I'm wondering.
I don't remember hearing that before, but then my memory is sometimes hazy.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard him say it before either.
No, I don't think he specifically named it. So I wondered what the connection is there. Between them, they have a little discussion about whether Gilgamesh should even be on the throne. And actually, that Hina has reservations about this. And Enkidu also wonders whether the mission from the Winthrops is a trap. Meanwhile, the rest of the party arrive back at Plumbridge. And there's a really, really, really funny scene with Gwen and Cassula, where Cassula invites Gwen to go and warm down in the garden. And Gwen's desperately trying to say sorry to Cassula, but she's stubborn. And you can so relate to this, can't you? Between like a mother figure and a kind of adolescentish child. And yeah, they sort of exchange blows a little bit. And that's brilliant. I love it. And eventually she does say sorry and they clear the air between them. And that was just a really beautiful moment, which I think Gwen has been almost like waiting for that moment since the very beginning of having this burden on her chest of letting the family down. And all of a sudden, you know, the apology is given, the apology is accepted, and it feels like she can almost move on. So that's lovely.
Oh, I had a question.
Yeah.
Did you guys know that Cassula was Gwen's stepmom before now? Because if we did know that, I blanked it. I was like, wait, what?
I think I assumed because her mother was orcish and we knew that Cassula wasn't orcish.
I just missed the also married to Gwen's dad and
got ya.
Is her mentor as well. Like I completely missed that when it was earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just thought she was like her mentor, like her training, you know, her personal trainer, basically.
I think maybe that was what it was first and then perhaps the marriage came later. That's the impression that I've had in my head, but maybe I've just created a story around what I want it to be.
It seems that Gwen's family has a thing for falling for people that they hire to do unrelated tasks.
Yes, yes. Prison Company included.
So true.
Yes. Like father, like daughter, I guess.
Yeah. And then the other interesting bit about this episode was whilst Gwen is out with Casula, the rest of the party are in the kitchen eating some sandwiches, and Oren finds a very interesting book. And this is a book about the lineages and kings and their spouses of Drevaen. And there's a lot of information. But the important thing is that it has all of the sort of kings. I don't know if we have queens in this world. Do we have queens? Or is, I think it may be just kings.
I don't think we've
heard of a queen. Kings and their spouses. And the King Harish, who was the last king who has recently died, who Enkidu was at the palace with, died not long after Enkidu left, only 3 months or so. He had no spouses, but looking back through this book, all of the kings died or succumbed to some kind of disease or sickness of the mind. And that was what they gleaned, that there's some kind of pattern going back all the way through, right back to Rumath Taribor, where all of these kings, succumbed to some kind of mental illness. And it was fatal.
Did this not feel like such a Game of Thrones Ned Stark season one situation
Very
where
much
he's going
so.
To black of hair? Yeah. It's just so oh my god.
And the Targaryen Mad King, that whole side of it as well.
Yeah.
So that makes us wonder whether actually the steward is doing Prevost a favour by keeping him away from the throne, and actually maybe there's something more sinister going on with that. And it also makes me question about Kral.
Yes, I was literally about to say, this feels like it's got Kral all over it.
And maybe Kral was wronged, and that actually he knew that this was coming for Rumath, and his divination magic looking down all of the strings was to try and prevent it. And then he ended up catching whatever sickness it was himself. That's my new little theory.
I also do have a little bit of a thought, though. What if Enkidu's mental situation is related to this? Because isn't the possibility is that Gilgamesh may be in some way connected to the royal family?
Yep.
Enkidu may be connected.
What if there is no Gilgamesh? What if there has only been an Enkidu?
Enkidu is actually
And Enkidu is.
I'm so on board with this theory.
And the mental illness is like him essentially having alternate personalities that begin to appear in his mind. And maybe there's something like magical about it, that these are like, this is some kind of a curse, or even like presences, like spirits that are being passed down from like family member to family member.
We did have a talk, like it was like ages ago, with the whole, I think it was around the Erida arc, about like where did these people inside Enkidu go, and we sort of talked a little bit about like dissociative identity disorder and like how, you know, in our world, not the fantasy world, you know, that is usually caused by some extreme trauma. So the mind essentially fragments, and these sort of alternate personalities come in to protect the self in order to survive horrific trauma. Yeah. And there's something about Enkidu's story that really says that to me, that there was some kind of overwhelming horrific trauma that happened in the fight with Alcibiades and his personality splintered. And so he is not, like you say, there is no Gilgamesh. They're all Enkidu, and Enkidu is all of them, and they're all inside him, and it's just him. And maybe they're based off some friends he has had, or maybe they've just been imaginary friends he's had his whole life that he's never realized are imaginary. And so it's, I'm fully on board with this theory.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
This reminds me of, there was a really, really hugely acclaimed production of the Oresteia. It was a new adaptation. It's a trilogy of Greek plays, if you're not familiar, done by Robert Ick or Ike, I've never known how to pronounce that guy's last name. But it was the one that he won his first Olivier Award for best director. And he also had, it was like a new adaptation that he made. And in this version, normally you have the parents are Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, and then they have three kids, Iphigenia, Electra, and Orestes. Iphigenia is killed before the story starts, and then later on, Electra and Orestes have various interactions and various pivotal things that they do. But in this version, it was revealed that Electra never actually existed and was an alternate personality that Orestes created to get over the trauma of his mother killing his father and his father killing his sister. And that when Electra starts encouraging him to kill his mother, it's like the part of him that was formed from that trauma telling him to get revenge for the trauma that was inflicted on upon his family.
I wish I'd seen that.
Yes, it was really, really good.
Sounds like such an awesome interpretation.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. But it reminds me of this, where perhaps this is some sort of trauma that Enkidu suffered. Perhaps Enkidu is even like not a, perhaps he was, if we're saying he's the true heir, maybe it's like a, for the Game of Thrones comparisons, look, the show's already out. Maybe it's like a Jon Snow situation where he should have been the next one in line for the throne. But
and he hints that, doesn't he? Because he says he grew up in a brothel with a sex worker who kind of, I think he said his mum was a sex worker or he was looked after by a sex worker. Yep. But then there's the insinuation that his dad is the king.
Yeah. What if all of these other what if Gilgamesh is what his name actually should be?
Mm. Right? Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. It all makes sense.
It's all making sense now.
I'm going to message Daryl after this and be like, I called it, bro. And send him my whole theory.
All the super fans have got your number.
Yeah, I'm sending him a message detailing all my theories now.
When they were in the room at the Wingthrup workshop, when all the names first came out, were any of those five in his head? Did any of those names actually get listed?
I don't think so.
No, because I think Enkidu was, they didn't have Enkidu there asking about the names because he was in, that was when they were trying to access him.
It was right at the beginning, I think.
Codex, wasn't it?
I may be wrong. I'll have to go back and check.
Remember. Yeah, we've got to re-listen to that bit, which came first.
Yeah.
I was also wondering as well with this like disease of the mind thing,
whether
there's something to do with the mirrors because when they went down and saw the mirrors, they're like different mirrors. Obviously one of them is Kral's, one of them is this like thing that was smashing against it, and some of them were scratched out saying like do not trust. And if they're mirrors that connect all these different people, and one of them was like Kral's connection to Rumath Taribor, for example, is there something about the mirrors that is corrupting that sort of is creating the disease of the mind sort of through the timeline? And that's
it's
part
possible.
Of it as well.
It's possible.
I don't know.
I also wondered whether it was similar to what we have, again, real world, with the whole haemophilia thing being passed through the British. I don't know if it's British or German. My history is appalling.
It was through basically all of Europe.
The royal lineages passing down haemophilia. I wonder whether it was a similar idea with this. And that's why they're trying to get someone not directly from the bloodline in order to kind of eradicate this.
Because they're all
disease.
Inbred.
I'll try not to say it, but
they're trying to introduce some new blood into the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Just diversify a
diversify
little bit.
The gene pool.
Just a little bit.
Trying to get rid of that Habsburg jaw.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
Just make it a little bit healthier.
So yeah, it was an episode of a lot of information, a lot of details, and that just spurned a whole load more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as it always does.
Yeah. Favorite moments from this set of three.
I would like to pick because it was very silly and very inconsequential, but I really enjoyed it. There was a moment in that episode, episode 60, where Oren and Gwen discussed cake. Just throwing back to Gwen going, I really want some cake, and Oren going, yeah, and then Gwen saying, oh, we could have a bit of frosting as well. And it was just lovely to have a lighthearted moment after all of the shit that went down in episode 59. It was nice to have a little lighthearted moment. And I really enjoy the chemistry between Gwen and Oren. There's like that big sister, little brother kind of vibe, even though I guess they're similar age or maybe even Oren's a bit older.
Oren's 78.
Yeah.
Is Oren secretly 200?
But that was my favorite little moment. I really enjoyed that little interaction.
So sweet.
I would say the part my favorite part is probably when the Arcanist showed up and then just immediately cleaned house. And it's like, oh no. There was like a genuine like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
Oh, this is that, like, it is, as obviously it was more violent than typical for the show, but I was like, whoa, I'm genuinely shocked at how this went. Not only because, like, this is our heroes just getting spanked, but like this is a lot more serious than even the serious stuff usually feels. I really liked that. Yeah. It added a new sense of scale.
Yeah. It's just like a whole other dimension to the entire podcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I'm just going to have to choose Gwen and Kasula, because it was so different to what I was expecting, I think, like, because of the way Gwen has experienced her leaving. I think we only saw the event through her experience and then meeting up with Dwayne, and that kind of thing, and kind of little tidbits that June has thrown out there. So I really got the sense that her family were kind of like on the side of the DeBarges, and they'd be really angry, and she didn't want to contact them in case, you know, they'd be really pissed at her and try and get her to come home. And, you know, there was like a big retribution waiting for her. And actually,
it was fine.
They're really kind of proud of her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, Kasula's like, no, you did what you wanted to do. Good for you, kind of, almost in a way, which is like, it just really threw me in such a lovely way where I was like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
And it was just like a really lovely, like a very Gwen moment of going in and that stubbornness and like being like, I'm not going to apologize, but also I really respect Kasula like so much. And like, it just felt really lovely to listen to. I really enjoyed it. That like character development. It was really
nice. That's a good choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
When do you guys think Dwayne is going to show up again?
Oh my God, soon, please.
Are you
I
asking
really
because
so.
You know, or are you asking because...
I'm literally asking, like, wow, based on what's happening on the story and then what happened in the Dwayne Fabulosa side thing, I'm really interested to hear when their paths cross again.
Oh my God, it'd be so cool.
And it's a different Dwayne now as well, actually.
It's true. Yeah, he's undergone some real changes.
Yeah.
He can't lie anymore.
Growth.
Oh no. That's such a big part of his identity.
What's he going to do? He's going to have to start telling the truth.
Oh, he's just going to have to start making the truth sound really good.
Yeah. I mean, he can't lie, but he can still embellish.
Yes. And he can always just give selective truths. But like,
that's true.
I imagine he would not show up until post Spoons. So whenever that happens.
Oh my God, that's never. This is just going to keep going forever. No, Jeremy, don't say
how
that.
How many
we'll
spoons
never
do they have?
Again.
How many, they, how many like do they need six. And how many do they have?
They need 10.
10. They need 10. I think they've got like 6.
They have 6? Okay. In my head, I'm
four,
like, did they
six?
Get like 2?
I don't know.
They're about halfway there.
Maybe 4?
Get a move on.
I think every challenge they've done so far, they've been successful. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. But how many have they done?
I can't remember.
3? There was the tightrope one.
There was the count how many spoons on the tray one.
Yeah.
There was...
shoot the bag of stuff.
Okay,
yeah.
3.
And Gwen made
that's
a
3.
Girlfriend.
Yeah. So I guess they have 6?
There's been 2. I think maybe there's
I'm
been
sure there
have
been
two
more. Is the tightrope one the same one as the posts? Where they
that was the one. Yeah, it was
the
tightrope. Yeah, they were having it. It was the balancing. Yeah, the balancing challenge.
God, maybe they've only got 3.
Well, do they get 2 from each one or do they only get the 1?
No, they just get the 1.
I'd love to see a spoon tracker.
Oh,
I'd love to just like have that
yes.
like, as a little marker just on their website, like spoon tracker.
We need to suggest this in the Superfan chat, in the Superfan chat so that we can get ourselves a spoon counter just so that we can know.
Yeah.
Because this is like the first season of Pokemon where it's like 100 and something episodes. And it's like how many, like most of these episodes have nothing to do with getting badges. How many badges does Ash have now?
Yeah.
Oh, such a good reference. Well, if you want to join us in badgering David in the cast to get a spoon tracker, you can join the Discord where we can just incessantly spam messages about like how many spoons have you got and seriously, how long is this going to keep going on? Or if you want to have even more access and even more power, you could join the Patreon where you get all kinds of cool behind the scenes stuff. Daryl's just started doing a segment only for patrons, which is Rambler's Rest, where he just chats to some people from the cast and kind of adjacent to the podcast. And you just get to have like a lovely, listen to a lovely chat with Daryl. Yeah. So that's going on. I did one with him. As well as,
I don't know if it's, I don't think it's been released yet, but I did one with him.
Well, it's exclusively for Patreons.
Yeah. So if you want to hear me chat with Daryl about all sorts of stuff.
Always.
I mean, yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Go, of course we do.
Go check out the Patreon at some point. Yeah. It'll be up. I don't know when.
And there's other cool stuff as well. Like you get to vote on stuff that David puts into the world sometimes, and there's maps, and then you get pre-releases. It's really, really, I think it's worth it to support this podcast.
Definitely.
And all those subclasses he's made.
Oh, yeah. You get all his homebrew stuff.
Yeah. The man's a subclass
machine.
I have
yet to use it, but and they're all really well made. Mm-hmm. Again, how does he do this? How does he have the time? He's got magic, I'm convinced. Do you guys have anything you want to plug?
I don't know when this is coming out, but we got a... Got an actual play series on Three Black Halflings. It's called Curse of the Spider Queen. It's Tales of Wogadu, The Curse of the Spider Queen. It's very, very good. It's sort of a distant sequel-ish to the first series that we did, the Cub and the Caterpillar, although you can listen to this without having listened to the Cub and the Caterpillar, and I think you'll have a different experience than someone who has, but it's not so built on that show that you're going to be like, what? Like, it's got all new characters. The world has changed. It's set like over 100 years after the event of that show. Just go in and just check it out. It's a lot of fun.
Great stuff. Amazing.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. This has been so fun. I can't wait to see you all again.
And we're under an hour.
For now. Maybe that's our cue to sign off.
Sign off. Quick sign
off. Bye, everyone. Bye. Goodbye.
Are we going to do it?
We're going to do it.
Okay. Ready?
Yes.
Anon for now.
We're all trying to listen to each other.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.